10-yard touchdown, running into first place for number one.
Harris drops back, fades to the left, pressure on, and he goes down. Ja'Garrett Davis gets home, and the all-black sideline explodes here in Hamilton.
Caught at the five, it went through Marcus Dale's hands, and Kyren Moore, the presence of mind to catch it and step out of bounds at the five with 20 seconds to go.
Pressure loads it up, goes down the field, taking a shot into the end zone. He caught it. Touchdown, Tigertown. Brandon Banks, how did he do it? It is the breakdown right here on Canadian Football Perspective. I got to ask here, DT, off the top, because I like to examine each of those calls a different way every time. How bad was the through the hands on Marcus Sales? You made it sound very dramatic.
Oh, it was absolutely, it was right through his hands to the point where I was set to say that this game is over. It's one of those ones as a play-by-play guy, right? You're like, oh, this is going to be bad. Oh my God, it's not bad.
Yeah.
Kyren Moore caught it and they're still alive and now they're guaranteed to win the game. Oh crap. Right. Honestly, at that point, when that happens to Sales, one of the best halves in the league, I thought, man, the Riders are destined to win this game because you can't get these bounces and then lose.
Yeah.
That's not how the story goes. And clank.
Trying to think of my best play-by-play genuine shock moment. It might be Trey Roberson blocking a field goal against the Ticats for Calgary with his elbow. I was I was like, hey, Liram Hirelahu, the Cats haven't won in Calgary in a billion years. This one's got to go. And I'm like, I trust the long snapper, who is Aaron Crawford. I trust the holders, Luke Tasker. I trust the kicker, Liram Hirelahu. This won't be that hard. Oh, he blocked it with his face. And I just remember being in the booth and like coming out of the 60-1 game that we've talked about before with Ricky Dam Stanzi being there. I'm like, I can't believe we're back here 2 years, whatever it was, 3 years later. And they got a chance to win this game. And all right, there we go. It's for the fan. Nope, it hit Trey Roberson's elbow because he has a 97-inch vertical. That was probably my genuine. How did you experience the Trey Roberson elbow block?
I now have to go back and look at it. Like, I got to pull it up on the CFL media site because I do not remember it at all.
We just laughed. It was Morielli and I are calling the game on radio. And I remember we had to do like a little 10-minute post-game wrap-up kind of thing before we threw it back to the studio for the actual post-game show. And in the post-game show, we were watching the blocked field goal at the end, and we were trying to be articulate about it and break it down in a way that we thought would be entertaining. And it just came off as us giggling because we're like, that's ridiculous. Nobody should block a field because it was longer, so we drove it low, right? He didn't want to hang it up in the air. But it didn't come out like it was shot to the back of the offensive line's head or anything. I mean, it still had some angle. And it's funny because I watched it back, I forget why, a little while ago. And I ended up seeing, I'm like, okay, where's Trey Roberson? Because I know he blocks it. And I see where he is. And even just looking at him before the snap, he's as tall as everybody else. And I'm like, this is going to be crazy. And sure enough, the snap goes back. And all of a sudden, he's twice the height of the offensive line blocking for it, and it hits him square in the side of the forearm as he's jumping up. And I'm just like, when you got room to kill like that, then man, that's a hell of a thing. Welcome to the show, everybody. Thank you for being here. As always, Canadian Football Perspective Podcast is brought to you by our friends at Fox 40. You already know that, the worldwide leaders in whistle technology. For 15% off all your return to play whistle needs, visit fox40shop.com and enter the code CFP15. If you're watching on YouTube, looks a little bit different today. That's because DT is actually in and around the Sports Cage studios because he is allowing me to work my schedule around and do stupid things that I have to put him in bad situations in order to get this podcast done. So I thank you, DT, for putting it together here with me today, because we are doing this on a bit of short notice. But unlike some of the pods that we've done in the last couple of weeks, we have genuine stuff to talk about because the Hall of Fame gets announced here. Very exciting class. We will get to your thoughts on that coming up right after this, which is actually my hit on the Sports Cage that I did with you today. Tell people where they can catch the Sports Cage if they are interested in everything that this sounds like.
At 620ckrm.com is the place to go during the show. It's 4 to 6:30 Saskatchewan time. So right now that's 6 to 8:30 Eastern time, 3 to 5:30 Pacific time. The podcast, you just go to wherever you get podcasts, hit up at Sports Cage. And every Tuesday at 4:30, we speak to a brilliant CFL analyst from Canadian Football Perspective named Marshall Ferguson.
There you go. Let's listen in to us listening in.
620 CKRM.
All the guests of the show appear on the Western Pizza Hotline. Don't feel like cooking tonight? No problem. Just order Western Pizza with contactless delivery available. He is a CFL analyst, and I guess according to the music, the former lead singer of Motorhead. It's Marshall Ferguson. What's up, dude?
Not much. Hell of an intro. Yeah, I like that.
Not bad at all. It had a little WWE vibe to it.
I was waiting for the smashing glass and then for me to just come rumbling out like Roman Reigns or something.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Marshall Ferguson, the Canadian Football Perspective, joins us every Tuesday. Seven dudes going into the Hall of Fame, Marshall. Pick one and tell me why you love it. Is it Nick Lewis? Is it the coach of your team, Orlando Steinauer? Give me one you like.
Yeah, I think Nick Lewis is deserving. I love everything that Nick is and his journey throughout the CFL, because anybody who knows where Nick began knows his background, knows how colorful he is, his personality, knows how much of a fun time he likes to have, knows how much of an intimidating person he was on the football field because he was just an unnatural size by the end of his career and still doing things that he did when he was pretty skinny. Like it's funny to look back at the start of his career and be like, yeah, hell of a kick returner. And then see the end where he's flying through the sky in the 2014 Grey Cup, trying to get to the goal line against the Ticats defense. And so I have great respect for him. I've always enjoyed what Nick has brought to the Canadian Football League, and I'm really happy to see him get in. Orlando Steinauer is the one for me. I dove in on the media availability that we had through the CFL to chat with him. I watched some of the old Grey Cup stuff, 98, 99, that he played in with the Ticats, just to kind of go back and get a sense for how he was discussed and the way that people thought of him during that time period. And I love his story, I think, more than anybody else. It's not that he's the Ticats head coach. It's that he was with the Ottawa Rough Riders for 5 weeks. He only played in two of those weeks. Then he's only on special teams. He's not even a DB. He's a Western Washington guy where, as he said in his media availability, you go there to either become an engineer or a teacher. And I wasn't no engineer. So he went there to get his education degree. He does that. He goes to the Detroit Lions. He ends up getting cut from them. He thinks his football career is over. He's like, well, this was fun. That's in 1995-96 that Orlando Steinauer is like, well, time to close up shop. This thing's over. Ottawa ends up calling, gets that opportunity. They fold. And again, he goes, well, that was fun. And then Hamilton takes him 12th overall in the dispersal draft. He goes there, and in 97, he leads the league in interceptions. So his journey of I'm here, no, I'm not. I'm here, no, I'm not. It's just like he never gave up, and he always stayed pretty low-key and grounded, and he just kept making plays. And over time, it went from, hey, who's that kid on Ottawa on special teams? Maybe we should give him a shot in the draft. Oh, why not? Let's take him too. Oh, look, he's leading the league in interceptions in 97 too. Oh, he might be the best DB on a team that goes to the Grey Cup 2 years in a row. And then he gets a shot in the NFL with the Dolphins. And he ends up going down there, messing up his knee, comes back to Ontario, bounces back and forth between the Ticats and the Argos. He gets traded for Mike O'Shea when it's Hamilton to Toronto. And O'Shea gets sent from Toronto to Hamilton. And then he goes back to Hamilton 2000, plays in a playoff game. And then he sticks back with the Argos 2001 for 8 years. I mean, his journey, I find it to be so interesting how he was able to weave in and out of CFL history, from the Ottawa Rough Riders to dispersal drafts, to dabbling in the NFL, to being a small school guy, making it in the pros. So I think he's a really fun story. And of course, it only adds to the lore of his tale that he is now doing what he's doing as a head coach after being a coordinator and a really, really good positional coach as well.
Marshall, looking back at Nick Lewis's career, to me, nothing trumps the nine straight 1,000 plus yard seasons, but was his adaptability overlooked throughout his career in your mind? The way you said, you know, he was able to adapt as he got older, kind of went from that lanky guy to what someone that looked like a tank, but still had deceiving speed.
Yeah, he was funny, man. Like, Drew, to me, when I think about his career evolution, it's almost like Vince Carter going from being high-flying dunker to, oh, you want me to learn how to shoot a three-pointer? Yeah, sure. That's not hard. And he just kind of evolves as time and everybody starts shooting more threes. And Nick kind of did that same thing where he looked at it and said, I can do whatever you need me to do. I can still stick around here. And it's almost that kind of Jason Witten feel where no matter what happened with the Dallas Cowboys for what felt like an eternity, It's like, well, it doesn't matter if it's Romo or somebody else. Witten's just going to run 3 yards, turn around, and he's always going to be open because he always just knew where to settle in the spacing between the linebackers. He understood leverage. He understood timing. And if you think about what Nick did, and again, I don't want to undersell his athleticism because I do think that that evolved over time. But when I think about Nick later in his career, it's not him running past people or running through people. It's him outthinking people. And I don't think we give him enough credit at the back end of his career for how smart of a football player he was. If you really watch what he did, there's nobody, I think, in the last 10 years, maybe Andy Fantuz, I could include in this conversation, who's used the waggle as a slot back to more of their advantage. Like Nick just, he just toyed with people. He became such a veteran of what he wanted to do, setting you up at the line of scrimmage, that I can remember a game against Hamilton before I was ever calling games. I think I was in university at the time, where Nick Lewis de-cleated a defensive end by just chopping him down on the end of the line of scrimmage on a toss play or something. And, you know, he cracks down the line and he ends up blowing this defensive end who probably weighed less than him at that point in his career. But he ended up throwing him basically to where the middle linebacker was. Like, just the guy ended up horizontal and he chucked him. And then the next play, he was so fired up. I remember this is why it sticks out in my mind, that Nick waggled towards the same D end and just started head pumping him. It just started, like, just stood next to him, was like, I'm going to do it again. And as he was doing it, that defensive end is like, oh Jesus, please don't. And he got so into the fun of the game because he became so comfortable inside of what the CFL was, that that's what allowed him to adapt. And that's what made him such an entertaining personality as well, is he reached this kind of masterclass point of knowing how to do his job, that he didn't have to do anything spectacular in order to rack up year after year after year of successful seasons.
He is CFL analyst Marshall Ferguson with us on the Sports Cage. Global Draft comes up on Thursday, and I want to throw this out to you and take your temperature on it. What could be done with players from the Global Draft? I just saw today Washington has signed tight end Sammys Reyes, a young man who has never played football in his life. He came up from South America to play Division I basketball, but someone put him through some combine tests, and they went, oh, wait, you're 6'5", 260 pounds. You ran the 40 in 4.65. You did 31 reps on the bench at 225 pounds, and you have a 40-inch vertical. You know what? We're going to make you a tight end. That's been happening in the NFL for quite a while. Antonio Gates, it was the first one. There were at least three in the league last year. Is that possible to be done with the global program in the Canadian Football League, or is the NFL just so rich they can fool around with stuff like that?
Yeah, I think the NFL has a little bit more flexibility to make mistakes than the Canadian Football League does because of the roster sizes and because of the size of the practice rosters and things of that nature. But I would say this as well, that the tight end specifically, I think, lends itself to get an athletic freak who has tangible skills that might not be applicable on the surface to football, but we can make them applicable to football over time. That's something that you can do with defensive ends and tight ends, I think. And of course, in the Canadian Football League, the true inline tight end is a dinosaur. I mean, it's gone the way of the fullback essentially on most teams right now. So, and DT, I know you and I, we are both fans of the big bodies in the box, being able to mix it up and line up as an H-back or a fullback or a tight end that can motion. I mean, it gives you more flexibility and it gives offensive coordinators more imagination. But in the NFL, yes, they're spreading things out. There's a lot more three wide, four wide sets. But you still have Travis Kelce's of the world. You still have Gronk doing what Gronk did this year in the NFL coming out of retirement. So I still think that they're more open to taking that position that doesn't really truly exist in modern CFL offenses. With that being said, the concept that you speak of what can be done with global players, I think is absolutely worth investigating, because there are always going to be guys from around the world, every single corner of the world, who are athletic. Like if I were to go to anybody on the street and go, hey, do you think that there's a great athlete somewhere in Laos? Do you think that there's a great athlete somewhere in Argentina? They're going to go, yeah, there's great athletes everywhere. What's your point? I'm going to go, okay, now, do we want to sell them on the idea of possibly being a hero in their country because they conquer a sport that's never really been conquered in their country before? It's like, well, that doesn't sound half bad. And it's like, okay, let's start to look. And I think we're seeing more and more of NCAA schools starting to end up having guys that are recruited from overseas, primarily Europe right now, because it's the easiest pipeline, I think, between the amount of coaches that have gone over and been involved in Europe that have some North American experience. It's an easier transition. There's more pipelines there. For example, there's a quarterback that's coming from the UK Academy that's going to the University of Ottawa Gigi's that's been recruited. And we're starting to see more of those relationships and partnerships where it's like Jeff Reinbold, the special teams coordinator at Hamilton, knows Marcel Belfay, and Jeff Reinbold is over there in the UK. And he finds out about this quarterback who's great. He says, hey, would you be interested in going to Canada? The kid says, well, I'd be open to it. What does it look like? What would that happen to kind of play out like? And he says, well, let me introduce you to my friend Marcel Belfay. So you're going to start seeing more, I think, sharing between both sides of the pond, specifically maybe more places as this progresses into Central America, South America, into Asia, other places. But I really do think if you can find an athlete and you can shape them, you can turn them into a lot of different positions. I actually think in the CFL, it's most applicable to just straight up receiver. Like if you can teach somebody who's really freaky athletic that has good hands, hey, here's how the waggle works. Here's how CFL football offenses work. That's directly applicable. You don't have to be 6'5", 240 and run a 4.5. But I do think that that's probably the easiest transition as of right now, maybe outside of defensive end, because as you know, you can pick up a guy who can just rush the passer like crazy from anywhere on the planet that's big, strong, and fast.
Yeah, you can teach guys the rules of football, and whether they catch on to them or not is independent of the fact that there are some people that are just, I mean, everybody in the CFL is like a 99th percentile athlete, but there are some guys that are not currently in the CFL that are in this global combine, the global draft, that are crazy. The CFL player would look at them and go, that's crazy. That's crazy what you're doing. And I'm a pro athlete saying that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's going to be the shocking part is when we start getting, and my fingers are crossed, hoping that this is going to come to fruition, of course, is if we start to get a consistent pipeline, they're not all going to be home runs. Like that's irresponsible to go out here and say, absolutely everybody that comes across is going to be a threat to starting positions and be a stud. That's not true. But what is true is that I believe for every 10 to 15 players you bring over, one of them is going to jump out, especially as the quality starts to go up, as you start to do this more consistently. And I do think that if you find somebody who's really freaky athletic, and we see this all the time. I mean, even, you know, small school guys like McNeese State or somewhere down in South Texas, and they end up coming into the league and we think, it's just that's a mini camp signing, whatever. They'll be gone before they even get to May or June. And then they get to training camp. Yeah, they make some plays. Nice. They get into a preseason game. Okay. They made a really nice interception at defensive back. Okay, well, maybe they'll be on the practice roster. Boom, two guys roll their ankles. You're the field corner. And they get in, you know what I mean? Like there's a progression here that this is going to be a slow burn. And anybody that's interested in the global program or even disinterested and says there's no way this is ever going to happen, if you wait it out and they stay at it and they continue to find athleticism that can be shaped, that's open-minded and raw, because keep in mind, I think you're going to get a lot of athletes that are from other sports that are dabbling into football, who are not necessarily football lifers. And people will say, well, they're too raw. That means that they can't be shaped into a professional football player. I would rather have somebody who's raw and doesn't have negative habits than have somebody who's hardened with bad habits over time. So I think what you're going to see these guys coming over, they're going to be shaped, molded, they're going to be worked on, and hopefully they're going to get the opportunity to actually prove that, because this can't be some type of window dressing of, hey, look how fun the global prospects are. Mm-hmm. If they get that shot and they have that athleticism, then I do think you're going to start to see the quality go up over time. Where that goes, I have absolutely no idea, but I'm here for it. I hope that we get to find out.
Yeah. And you mentioned where it goes. It's tough to tell right now, but if it's as successful as we want this to be, do we start to see, you know, rugby players becoming running backs, or soccer players becoming kickers and things like that? Is there one position that maybe if you just had to predict that could stick out to you?
Well, it depends. Is Chris Jones coming back to the Canadian Football League? Because he'll turn anybody into anything. So I would love to see Chris Jones come back in the CFL and be like, well, wait a minute. I can take a European handball player and I can turn him into what I want. But that's amazing. No, I do think that you'll end up seeing the strictly physical positions. And again, you can say anywhere on the football field is a physical position. But I really do think DN, running back, and receiver to me jump out. Because there's a little bit of technical skill. Being able to flip your hips and run a DB is so important. I don't think you're going to see a lot of free safeties because you got to be able to read the field from sideline to sideline and be able to jump routes and understand route concepts. That comes with time. that comes with eye discipline and being able to get reps. And if guys are relatively raw, I don't think that's where the athleticism will necessarily come. At the same time, you know, in the boundary as a defensive backfield, your corner is typically a big Division I monster. And your halfback is somebody who has D1 experience because they're just super athletic and getting involved in the run game. So there's these limited spots, but there's opportunity in those limited spots that I do think we'll start to see. And honestly, I have always been a huge fan of the multi-sport athlete. This is, I think, part of the excitement that comes out of me. And this is, I hate the idea of kids that grow up, play one thing from when they're age of 3, age of 4, age of 5, grow up peewee, bantam, otherwise, and get into the upper echelons of the sport. A lot of people get burned out that way. And I think that there's a lot of stories of athletes who have found their happiness in a sport when they're in high school, or maybe when they're in their late teens, and they end up finding their way into it unintentionally, and they're better for it. They have, you know, for me, I played quarterback and I loved it, but I got into that because I was playing basketball and my high school basketball coach said, listen, you're not tough enough. You and the rest of the guys are going to go play football. I said, oh, okay. I don't mind that. I've always enjoyed watching football, so I'm happy to give it a shot. And they said, what position do you want to play? And I said, well, my favorite thing to do in basketball when I was playing point guard is to find open people. I love distributing the basketball. It's the best. And they said, well, that sounds like a quarterback. Would you be interested in that? I went, wait a minute. You're telling me there's a job where all I have to do is pass? Like that's, I don't have to do anything else. I don't have to defend. I don't have to take 3 points. I just get to give people the ball in smart places and allow them to make the plays. Yeah, that's kind of what quarterbacking is. That's amazing. I love that idea. So for me, I smile at the idea of people taking skill sets that they were fascinated by in other sports or that were applicable in other sports, bringing them into our game, which is a wide open, free-flowing, high-paced style of football, and being able to use those niche skill sets and apply them in a way that they can actually have success. So I do hope that happens. And I do hope that we just get some weird combos of people from all over the place from a variety of different sports.
Yeah, we'll be looking forward to it. The CFL's global draft goes on Thursday. Follow Marsh on Twitter at @TSN_Marsh, the Canadian Football Perspective podcast, 5 days a week, including the breakdown coming on Wednesday when Marshall and I will do our thing. Thank you, brother. I'll talk to you in a bit.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, DT. Thanks, Drew. All right, so that was me talking to DT. Welcome back to me talking to DT as we continue on here with the breakdown. It's fun. I always love going on the Sports Cage, partially because I just like you guys as human beings, you and Drew, but also because you guys ask really good questions, and it's fun to talk to people who actually know their bleep about Canadian football and don't just go, hey, what do you think is going to happen with this year? Like, that's the thing I get when I walk around my neighborhood right now, where I'm walking the dogs, and people are like, hey, you do the CFL stuff. What's happening? I'm like, don't know. Don't know if anybody knows. Not a damn clue. So it's nice to go on and actually talk some real football. I didn't give you a chance, though, because you were interviewing me on the Sports Cage to have your say on the Hall of Fame, DT. What do you think of this class? What jumps out to you?
I think that you talked about the evolution of Nick Lewis in his career, and it really makes me want to go back and see early Nick Lewis, because by the time I started charting football, he was Montreal Alouettes Nick Lewis, and he was big and he was slower than he was, but he was an absolute marvel, right? He'd be at that number three position to the field. And I took crap for voting him all-star when people are like, what, Brad Sinopoli plays there? I'm like, yeah, but Nick is jumping over dudes at 260 pounds or whatever. Guys Amazing. Would try to tackle him low. And there, when you try to classify broken tackles, which I've tracked for 5 years, there are different kinds of broken tackles. There's I shook a guy in the hole. There's I busted through a guy. And then for Nick, there was I jumped over a guy who thought he could take me out at the knees. And you go, how does this keep happening? How does this happen again? And I guess, honestly, just the alternative of, you know, getting jumped over was better than trying to challenge him at like waist or belly button height, because I feel like defenders felt like that was not going to go real well for them.
My standout memory, aside from that Decleter block against the Ticats that I mentioned there on my Sports Cage hit, is again against the Ticats. A lot of Calgary Ticats talk in this podcast so far with Trey Roberson and Nick Lewis. But there was a moment in the 2014 Grey Cup, right before Drew Tate, I believe, got the first of his two rushing touchdowns in the 2014 Classic, where Nick Lewis, at all of that 250-plus frame, just decides, I'm going to take off from the 6-yard line and see if I can get to the end zone by riding a wave of bodies, because he knew nobody could stop him. I forget who it was that ended up. It might have been Craig Butler, if I remember correctly, who was coming downhill, you know, because I think he caught like a little in-breaking route and he swatted a tackle aside and then he turned up field and he got to about the 10-yard line and you start to see the big man doing those little tiny choppy steps because it's like he's going to dunk, right? He's trying to line up his footwork. He's like, okay, I'm going to do it. And as I remember watching that, because 2014 was the year that I played my final football game ever, which was with McMaster in the Vanier Cup against Montreal. And so that was on the Saturday, and then Grey Cup Sunday was the next day. So I drove back with my family and my girlfriend at the time from Montreal to Kingston, to where I'm from. And we sat down and we watched the Grey Cup together, family tradition, always do it. And I remember sitting down to watch it and so early in the game, seeing Nick do that. And it just burned in my memory. I'm like, I don't know if I've seen a person that size try to do that at that part of the field. And it was just the funny thing about it too. And this is always so great about Nick is that he would take off from the six and try to body surf into the end zone. And then if he would get tackled at the one or get stood up by Craig Butler right at the line, because it was like, it took three bodies to pull him down. They'd always get a shot of his face afterwards. And it was never like him doing what everybody does. Yeah. Flexing and walking around and freaking out. And Nick would just, he was so chill. He's like, well, that's what I'm supposed to do. I'm a big ass dude. I'm super happy. And he was like, he would talk smack and you would always hear the mic'd up stuff of him talking and talking, but it was more than just the smack. It was like, he would talk smack because he just knew I'm unique and he could get away with so much because his skill set was so unique. And I'm talking like skinny Nick was unique and thick Nick was unique and everywhere in between. I mean, he was just, the whole career was just, and nobody has more catches. Like, that's the thing, is he caught everything.
Yeah. I haven't heard thick Nick in a while. Ah, that's good. That's good. Can we just go back to the part where Marshall Ferguson flexes? Can we get a little more of that? Maybe.
I went into the garage today and I did three sets of bench press and I felt weaker than ever. And I was like, nah, I'm good. And I just gave up on my entire workout. So that's how my day went. But I do want to mention here as well, like I know that Orlando Steinauer and Nick Lewis are, there's always the highlight names, right? DT, that gets, there's always the people that go into the hall where they get all the publicity, the love, the write-ups, all that stuff. But Marv Levy, man, that is cool. Like, that is really, really exceptionally unique to see him going into the Canadian Football Hall of Fame. And as a Bills fan, like, that's, to me, that's a really unique piece of history, because I bet you that I want to say anybody who is, I don't want to say anybody, but probably 90% of people who are younger than 40 just found out that Marv Levy was in the CFL, right? Like, everybody knows Marv Levy as Buffalo Bills, NFL guy, but I don't think people understand what he did in the CFL. And I remember going to Montreal with Coach John Salavanis, my color guy at the time, on radio. And he told me that. I'm like, no, he didn't. He's like, yeah, they're honoring him. Like, his name is up there. It's on. And when I found that out, I thought that's an amazing kind of full circle moment for football fans, specifically in kind of the East down here between Buffalo, Montreal, otherwise. But to see his name going up is pretty great. And then, of course, Mr. Mitchell going in as well as a builder, and the media wing. There's some fantastic people that have gone in there as well, the former Ticats radio voice and the director of communications for the Ticats. I mean, it's such a good group, and you wouldn't expect anything less, right? It's Canadian Football Hall of Fame, but it is pretty inspiring every year when you go through the details, because I do think that there's people out there that are in their 50s or 60s and they see all the names and they know all of them. The reason we lean to Steinauer and Nick Lewis is because they're relatable to the vast majority of CFL fans. But then you start digging into some of the research on the other guys and you're like, man, it's a special, special group. And I love being able to go through the details and the induction ceremony, which I hope is as normal as possible.
Yeah. My weird fact, my high school football coach played for Marv Levy in Montreal.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. So I knew long before you did. I was like 13 years old when I knew that that Marv Levy was a coach. Yeah, Ray Watchard, my high school football coach at Foothills Compton High School in Okotoks, Alberta, was on the offensive line for those Montreal Alouettes. And he would tell stories, Marv Levy and, oh, Johnny Rogers, kids, this guy that came up from America. And you're like, oh, my God, this is amazing. And then he just, his career finished in the beginning of the Warren Moon is ripping the CFL apart. That Warren Moon, Tom Wilkinson duo is ripping the CFL apart. His Montreal Alouettes got caught up in that, but he got a couple of Grey Cup rings in there.
That's crazy. I do need to give a little shout out to Sawdust City here. I'm going with an oldie, but a goodie today. I'm going with Little Norway, and I have to.
Right.
Yeah, contractually obligated that I have to do the crack into the microphone. I didn't steal that from Jay and Dan at all when they were down at Fox Sports 1. And so I always have you never seen the podcast where they used to do Yerba Mate at the start of every podcast? Yeah. Oh, man.
Dan would crack the Yerba Mate and Jay would be like, yes.
Well, that's how I feel about this beer. And the reason that I crack this right now is because you bring up the Warren Moon destroying the CFL era of football. I'm going through chronologically tracking Grey Cups from the past to look at quarterback metrics and fun stuff and just analyze and kind of bring them to life because, hey, the hell else are we supposed to do? We have no clue when the season's going to start. So I've been going through them. I had a ton of fun breaking down Sam Echeverry's record of 508 yards. That was inspiring to me to go back and to revive that and to tell people, hey, I know you've heard about this, but let me show you why this is crazy. And I had fun kind of trying to make that relevant to people of all ages. The next one that I'm writing that's going to be probably out by the time that people are pretty much listening to this, maybe a day or two afterwards, but is the Ticats and the Bombers playing in 6 Grey Cups in under a decade. And I'm breaking down those matchups and which players stood out, how the quarterback play fared in those games, because the last time we saw a Grey Cup being played in 2019, obviously, it was Ticats Bombers. We had no clue it was going to be the last football game in Canada that we would see in a long, long time. But the next time that we're supposed to see them play, kickoff is supposed to be the Ticats and the Bombers. And so I was kind of thinking beginning and the end. And because we're in this long, drawn out middle, I wanted to go back and look at those Grey Cups. And in those Grey Cups, DT, 57, 58, 59, 61, 62, 63, there's the 1962 Fog Bowl. He said as he took a long ass sip from this beer. This thing to track a game that was called the Fog Bowl is a special kind of hell. And 1961 is the first overtime Grey Cup game. That game took me forever to track because it just was so drawn out and so long. I told you previously there was a Grey Cup that was, I believe, 1954 that I told you Edmonton ran like 108 plays from scrimmage and they were 18% of them were pass play calls. This Grey Cup 1961, I don't think got to 108 for either team, but it felt like it got to 1,001 combined. Like they ran so many plays, dude. But I was very proud. I was able to piece together 2 different copies of whether it be radio play-by-play, television broadcast on CBC, and I only didn't have throw location data or depth of target, all that stuff, who it was intended for, whether or not it was complete, for 5 plays in the entire 1962 Fog Bowl. So nice. I'm hoping that I can bring some of that to life, but I needed the beer after I did that. I was like, this was a crazy thing to do, but I have to grind through the Fog Bowl and some of the repetitive 60s games in order to get to Warren Moon, in order to get to Joe Theismann at 71, in order to get to the 80s wide open game, in order to get to Flutie in the night. You know what I mean? Like so I'm kind of like, it's a slow grind, but I'm looking forward to getting to all of the rest of that stuff.
Yeah, I remember doing the 2017 Grey Cup in Ottawa where the snow came in and just trying to go, what yard line is this? What yard line is that pass caught at? On the XY, where is that on the horizontal? Is that 9 yards wide or is it 11 yards wide? So I can't imagine the Fog Bowl with fewer cameras and no all 24s and... Yeah, they didn't have all 24s available to the public back in the 60s, eh?
No, what's funny was they did have an end cut that at one point when I believe Hamilton was down inside the score zone, they're like inside the 20 to the 15 yard line, the end cut was crystal clear and they didn't use the camera for rest of the game. So that was funny where I was thinking, because you remember that game, I believe it was a Thursday night or it was a Sunday night game where New England had crazy fog that rolled in and they had to go to the cable cam, the sky cam, kind of like Madden. And they used it and everybody went, man, football's a lot better from this, which I have always said, all football should be viewed from the cable cam. That's the best way. We don't like the standard broadcast view is crap. You can't see a damn thing from it. You can't tell where receivers just run out of the picture and then they throw the ball. And we just turn the camera and we go, hey, look, he caught it. I wonder what he did. it'd be nice to actually see that stuff. So it was funny because in the Fog Bowl, it actually forced the hand, the evolution of the people that were directing that CBC broadcast, because they went to sideline cameras for live game action. And sometimes it was a throat directly towards the camera. And I was like, this is definitely the first time that this is, that must have been mind blowing for people at home to go, oh, I feel like they're running right into my living room, because it wasn't just perched up atop a stadium from the 50 yard line shooting down to the 55, I should say. So it was a cool experience to go back and check that out for sure. But it did, it forced the evolution of some of that broadcasting stuff. And there was a lot of incredible players on that roster. But I will say, I'm going to, at some point on CFP, on the website, I'm going to write, I don't know if it's going to be like an oral history or a review or what, but when they have the, and I implore people to go back and check this out if you want, it's on CFL.ca's Grey Cup portal for 1962, is that when they end up delaying the game to see whether or not the fog is going to dissipate, which, by the way, delaying the game for 5 minutes, hoping that fog that's been there for 3 hours is going to leave, is amazing. But they decide to delay the game for 5 minutes, and then they say, well, we're going to send the teams back to their dressing rooms. We're going to wait it out for 15 minutes. And in that span, CBC decides to go live to the sidelines, and they have their two reporters, whose name has escaped me right now, but they have two sideline reporters who we haven't heard from the entire broadcast. Apparently, they've just been roaming without a microphone on the sidelines, but they throw down to them, Derek, and they just start, they just start grabbing randoms, and they start interviewing randoms. and it's 15 minutes. It's like they bring in Jake Adar, who's not a random, but Jake Adar is the head of the Ticats at that point. They pull him over, and they pull over the owner, I believe, the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, and they basically just start asking them, hey, you think the fog's going to leave? And Jake Adar is like, I don't think so. I mean, it certainly doesn't look like it at this point, but there are some amazing interactions. At one point, they pull over a husband and wife who organized the halftime show and Miss Grey Cup. And Miss Grey Cup very obviously just wants to be on camera. Like, she's just there to get on national television. And it's an awful interview, but it is comedically perfect. So anyways, that's available on CFL.ca if you want to go check that out. The Hall of Famers that I mentioned there, whether it be Leo Lewis or looking around Ken Plain or Bernie Filoni, that got us thinking going into this. We just want to spend a couple of minutes here talking about who we think is currently playing in the Canadian Football League that could be Hall of Famers moving forward. And I saw that you tweeted this out today, Derek, and it was such a good idea to crowdsource it, because, man, some of the responses on that just made my mind churn. And I'm sure that you kind of dove into this when you were doing the Sports Cage today. But what did you take away from some of the conversations you had on radio, what you got from that tweet as well?
Yeah, so there were a few that I'd forgotten. I just kind of went over the current rosters of each team, and there are a few that left my mind. And I ended up with a lot, actually. Like, I have on my list 19 guys that I would put into the Hall of Fame, and then four guys that I kind of want to see where they go and maybe need a fraction more. It's...
What was your criteria? Before you tell some of your list here, I'm wondering how you kind of differentiated. Was it just, hey, I think of that guy highly enough? Or were you actually looking at, here's what you need to accomplish in order for me to give you this level of respect, expecting you to become a Hall of Famer?
So there was nothing quantitative to it. There wasn't yet to meet this. But there are guys for whom I go, well, you played at a super high level, but it hasn't been enough in the CFL. So I'm going to need to see a couple more years of you. And there are guys that just, it was so easy. Like, oh, Brendan Labatt. Yeah. Hall of Fame done. I don't have to think about much. I don't need to see exactly how many times he's been a CFL All-Star versus a West All-Star. You watch Brendan Labatt, you know how long he's been around. That guy's going to the Hall of Fame. Just some of it's easy. But you know, it was a radio one. But writing an article for CFP, I'd dive into it more and go, well, Justin Medlock, compared to every other kicker, has generated 75 more points above expected versus any other kicker, including Rene Paredes, who also should be in the Hall of Fame, like that kind of thing, right? But for the radio one, I just kind of started listing them off, and people were fantastic with, for some reason, I left Andrew Harris off the list initially, which is insane, because that dude is walking into the Hall of Fame regardless. I talked to Jeremy O'Day, the Riders GM, on the Sports Cage today. If you can guess who the first name, when I said to him what current CFLer should eventually be in the Hall of Fame, guess who he chose.
Is it a Rider?
No, it is not.
It's not
a
right.
It was Bo Levi Mitchell.
Okay, I was going to say, I thought he would have gone quarterback because that's where my mind went right away. And if you're going quarterback, honestly, just based on his tenure and the fact that he's probably closer to being done in the CFL, hate to admit it, but I would have gone Mike Riley off the front of my head. But yeah, Mike and Bo, I don't know if it's because they spent so much time playing against each other in Alberta with Edmonton and Calgary or not, but they feel like in so many conversations they're attached to the hip, and this is just another one.
Yeah, which led me to, and I'll get to my list in a sec, which led me to a stat I can't believe. Which of these is more outlandish to you, Marshall? Which of these truths is more outlandish? Ricky Ray was never the MOP of the CFL. Oof. Mike Riley is a one-time CFL All-Star.
Whoa.
Those are both outlandish to me, but both entirely true.
Know what's funny about that, though, is Bo had such a stranglehold on that throughout 2013, 14, 15, 16, 17, right? Like all those years that Riley was doing his thing and playing exceptionally well. And there was one time where for all of the, you out there who think that players don't read anything or don't listen to anything or don't watch anything, I ended up having a moment where Bo was in Hamilton for a game. And I think we had written like mid-season awards predictions was the article on CFL.ca. And for my MOP, I had put Mike Riley as my mid-season MOP. And like 2 weeks later, Hamilton ends up playing Calgary. Of course, Calgary wins because they seem to always be Hamilton. But you end up having Bo in the dressing room afterwards. And when I finish media availability, I run down to Calgary's locker room because I know Bo from when we were both in Calgary in 2013 when I was the U Sports intern quarterback. And so I went down just to say hi to him, and I walk in the locker room, and Bo looks at me and he goes, "Get the F out of here." I'm like, before I could do anything, he's like, "That's an effing joke." And he just starts dropping F bombs on me and in front of all of his teammates, right? Like everybody's half naked, getting dressed, coming out of the shower. And he looks at me, and I'm the only media member in the entire room. And it's all these players around. And I just go into the locker room to dap him up and be like, "Hey, man, how is everything? Like, you good? It's great to see you." And immediately he dives on me. And my face, because at this point I'm like, you know, 2-3 years max in the biz. So my face goes bright red. I can just feel it getting rosier and rosier because the quarterback, the Stampeders, is ripping me in front of his team. And I'm embarrassed as all hell. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? And he's like, "The hell are you doing putting Mike Riley as the MOP ahead of me in the middle of the season?" And I laughed so hard thinking back on it because I'm like, Mike didn't win anything. Like Mike never got given any of that stuff. And the second anyone suggested in that province that he might be better than Bo, Bo is not having it. And I still feel like he has that mentality about Trevor and Mike in BC and Zach coming into Winnipeg and Cody in Saskatchewan. Like Bo is like, the West is mine. And I'm going to prove it as many times as I possibly can. But I do laugh thinking about that because the nice thing that he did say was, "You're the only opinion that I respect because you're a former player." And I was like, "Oh, you're one of those guys who only thinks that if you played the game, then you're the only one who's allowed to have an opinion on anything," which even as a former player, I vehemently disagree with. But I do remember having that interaction with him. So it's funny that you bring up the limited amount of recognition that Mike Riley has gotten, despite being an incredible player.
Yeah, Bo knows reading, hey? Yeah, Bo's aware. Bo's aware. All right, I'm gonna run through my list of guys that are going to be in the Hall of Fame in my mind. Tell me if I go too far at any point. You ready? Crushing the beer. All right.
Yeah, sorry, Bo, I was drinking Levi beer. Mitchell. Go ahead.
All good. Bo and Mike Riley are on my list. Andrew Harris.
Yes.
I have SJ Green as a current CFLer. He might not be, but that dude's going to the Hall of Fame.
Absolutely.
Brendan Labatt, Charleston Hughes, and John Bowman. Mm-hmm. Almando.
There's a
Sito.
Lot, eh? Like I know that you said that you had a lot on your list, but you start to piece this together. Like you're not even halfway through, and every single one, yes, absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Sewell's going to the Hall of Fame. I think Ted Laurent is going to the Hall of Fame eventually. Yeah. Brian Burnham is absolutely on that track. Brad Sinopoli is going to the Hall of Fame. That guy's going to the Hall of Fame.
He's got the that maple, the double thumbs up twinge surrounded by all things red and white. He's gonna sail into the Hall of Fame for sure.
Odell Willis is going to the Hall of Fame. It's been rough for Odell the last year, But Odell Willis going, Simone Lawrence is going to get in under, Salmonell Mimian's walking in, Simone Lawrence is walking in too, because tackle machine.
Yeah.
Adam Big Hill is a current CFL.
Yep.
Stanley Bryant is in, is nonstop most outstanding lineman, Hall of Fame. Justin Medlock is the best kicker in the history of the CFL, Hall of Fame. Man. Rene Paredes should probably be in the Hall of Fame as well.
Yeah.
And Chris Van Zyl. I believe that's 19 in total, should be in the Hall of Fame.
That's incredible. Yeah, because I mean, when you said 19, I was thinking there's going to be someone in there that I'll go, wait, let's have a discussion on this person. Is there a single person that you can argue against in that group? Like, for me, maybe, and again, this is like, this is really squeezing in the smallest margins possible. Compared to that group, Almondo, but again, like, he's done so much statistically, he's racked it up year over year over year, and his all-star nods and all the rest of the things that we look at for this stuff. So it's like Simone and Ted, I hate to pair them together, but just the idea of, if you had to choose one of them, which of the two would you go with? Probably Simone, but Ted, I mean, it's, you can't, if here's the thing, if Sewell's going in, Ted's going in. Because kind of the same idea as Bo and Mike Ryder. They've always been attached to the hip in terms of performance and East All-Star and West All-Star and all that stuff. But was there anybody on the fringe of your list that you kind of had to cut? Okay, who was it that you didn't think was quite there? And I'm wondering whether this is because they weren't good enough or they're just not accomplished enough as of yet.
So these are four guys that I kind of want to see a little more of. And as you'll see, they're for a variety of reasons. So those 19, I think, have to be in the Hall of Fame at some point. The first one on the, I need to see a little more and maybe not a lot more with him, is Ed Gainey. Ed's been terrific for a long time. He's got the narrative of, he had a 10 pick season. He had four picks in a game. Ed's a real great player. I need a little bit more before I say Ed Gainey goes into that list of the Hall of Famers.
People in Hamilton are going to giggle or scream under their breath about that one, just because of Ellingson's miracle on Bank Street. They're going to end up saying Hall of Famer. I mean, he got run out of town because he couldn't knock the ball down. But you look at what he's done in Saskatchewan and you look at his career at large, and it's like, yeah, I mean, he's absolutely on that fringe. Now, it's interesting being on the fringe though, because the size of the group that we just talked about that are locks and Gainey playing in that same era. Like, I could see him getting pushed down the line, and I wonder how long he has to wait in terms of his era of players, because there are so many of them.
Yeah, and you can only, I mean, to keep it fair and to keep it the Hall of Fame, you can only put in so many at a time.
We can't be the NBA Hall of Fame where we're putting in 47 people every year, okay?
Yeah, exactly. So Ed Gainey is on my just about list. I had a tough time. Because I love Micah Johnson. Like, I love Slurpees. Like, I love Micah Johnson, and he's one of the reasons I'm so glad I started tracking CFL plays, because that guy straight up murders people in the interior.
Yeah.
Has he done it for long enough, and will he get to do it for long enough? Because I believe he'll be 33 this season. I believe he'll turn 33 this season. Don't quote me on that, but I wonder if there's enough time for him to put together two seasons of absolutely destroying people from the inside.
Yeah, interesting. Also, I want to ask you, is Sean Lemon on this list? Because I feel like there's a lot of similarities for what you're talking about with Micah, but off the edge from Sean.
Sean in the Odell Willis kind of category,
yeah,
right?
Right.
No one's proposed Sean to me. I should have, because he's been a contributor on the show and he's been helpful to me in my work. I have to go back and look, but
I only ask that because I know you're a huge fan.
That's a hard one.
Like, I know how much you love what he does in the field and how much he impacts the game. So I assume that if we're talking, Odell, Micah's impact and being fringy, I'm like, he's kind of, for me, it's like he's had the impact of Micah. He's got the style and the actual position of Odell. So that's, but again, like, you're talking about being 20 plus deep. And where does Sean rank in that big picture of all-time greats? I don't think that if you ask people to name the iconic players of this generation of CFL football, Sean Lemon's going to be in the top 10, 15 off the tip of their tongue. And maybe that's the purest way to go about this. I actually would be interested, you know, and maybe we'll throw this out there on CFP, because it is kind of the Hall of Fame announcement week here, but who are the players right now that define CFL football for you? You know, give us a top three, maybe we'll throw up there of players that define this era for you, because that's a different question than all-time greatness or statistical greatness. It's who would you remember in 20 years when I say 2019, 2015 to 2019, who will you remember? Because Sean's not high on that list, but that's also because he doesn't play a sexy position necessarily. And he's moved around a ton between franchises.
Yeah. And in that period that you mentioned, he's probably number two in quarterback pressures in that time behind only Charleston Hughes. This one is kind of hampered by some NFL stuff. And I just maybe it's just one more year. Willie Jefferson. I might need one more year because that's the highest heights that almost any defensive end has played at, what he did in 2019. I just need a fraction more and then he'll be a no-brainer.
How much more does he have to do, right? Because there's a difference between the compilers and the people who are sensational in short runs. And I do think that a Hall of Fame, you can't come in for 2 years, go crazy, leave, and be a Hall of Famer. I mean, even like Flutie, people might say, well, he wasn't around forever. He was around long enough. Like he was
8 years.
Yeah. Like these franchises and between BC and Calgary and Toronto. And like he had his impact on the league long enough to be able to have that conversation in short spurts. I think there's no question that Willie's one of the most dominant things that we have ever seen. So I do think that his window of expectation for how long he has to play and how long he has to sustain that greatness is probably shortened by the fact that he is so damn good. And the other thing is, we always talk about in NCAA football Heisman moments, right? Where a guy, Johnny Manziel's got to fumble the ball against Alabama, pick it up, scramble to the left, and throw a touchdown in Tuscaloosa. Willie Jefferson has his Heisman moment. It's beating up on everybody in and around the Toronto or the Hamilton Tiger Cats organization that was playing offensive tackle in the 2019 Grey Cup. Aside from other things, I mean, playoff games where he has the pick six, not mistaken, right? Like I'm thinking back to that one as well. So he's been in that marquee spot at the same time as he's been around a little bit, but yeah, I think he's going to get, there's going to be some expectation there that he sticks around for at least another 3-4 years, but based on Willie's social media, I don't think he's going anywhere.
Yeah. Like 19, 18, 17, absolute monster. 16. I believe he played 5 games with the Riders that year, which you're coming back from the NFL. I get it.
Right.
But I don't remember his Edmonton portion of his career. Obviously the Saskatchewan Winnipeg part has been phenomenal.
Crazy.
It's just been 3 seasons plus a bit. So if that was 5 seasons of absolutely destroying the league, then I whoop, arrow in, good, pass, go, collect $200, you're a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, I agree.
The last one is a little deeper cut, and if anybody who is great with offensive line play wants to hit us up and chime in at DT on SC. As I went through the list, I wondered about, will I say 5 years from now think that Christian Matt is a CFL Hall of Famer? Oh,
I thought that you were going to go Revenberg. I thought that was going to be the one, but yeah, Christian Matt is the more experienced of the two, right? So he's closer to the doorway, I would say, in that spot. But
well, I'm going to tilt the camera so I can pull my phone. Like Matt is not particularly old, and that guy is just 18 games a year. I'm in the middle. Where do you need me? You need me to play tackle? Cool story, bro. I'm going to do that. Doesn't really get a ton of love from outside of, I assume he's beloved. Oh my God, he's 35. Never mind. But he is nonstop. I honestly thought Matt was quite a bit younger than that.
Well,
but
the only reason
nonstop that 18 games a year from that guy.
Yeah, I'm with you. Revenberg, I believe, was drafted in 2015 or 16. So I think that he's still sub 30. You know, if we're doing one of these lists like they do with the media types where it's the top 30 under 30, there's no question that Rev is in that kind of demographic in terms of having the hope. And it is funny, though, to think guys that you just respect watching them play so much, because Matt's pretty high on that list for me, but Rev is right there alongside it. And like you say, Brent
LeBatt. One-time East All-Star? What the hell?
Yeah.
How is Christian Matt a one-time All-Star in a division? Anyway, well, sorry.
So I'm trying to think, though. So he's played the majority at center, no?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's think East centers. You've gone up against Sean McEwen, Mike Filer.
Yeah.
And who would have been in Ottawa for a while there? They've kind of been.
It's Mateus now. Well, John Gott would have been for a while.
Oh, yeah, true.
Yeah, okay. I get it.
So, I mean, that's the thing is awards are great because they're given to great players, but you also get squeezed if you happen to be in a great division. One of my favorite things in sports is to think about, because I've always been fascinated by this as a kid growing up in the 90s, the fact that, okay, MJ left to go play baseball for a couple of years, and you ended up having the Houston Rockets do their thing, and the Utah Jazz look better, and the Seattle Supersonics look better. And it's like, if MJ never leaves, do we even give a damn about the Rockets? Like, does Drexler get moved to the Rockets, and does Olajuwon get a championship? And I always think of that in modern NBA times where it's like, if Steph Curry doesn't exist, how many times has Portland won a championship? Like, because CJ McCollum and Damian Lillard are crazy. And I'm sure there's a ton of hockey context to that as well that you could apply of, you know, if Boston isn't what Boston became for a while there, what other franchises would have jumped up in and had a lot of success. But for me, when I think of Christian Mattes' spot, it's like, he's really, really good, but he got squeezed because there were guys that other people deemed to be better. And that also, like, let's be real about this, the CFL voting structure, there's a lot of times where it's local markets banding together and voting for people that they believe are the ones that should be, given credit. And I've never been a fan of that. Quick story for you on this that I found funny. Peel back the curtain here on CFL voting, because I don't know how often this happens in other markets. But I remember one time I got my CFL voting ballot, and Coach John Salavanis, one day when I came in, week 20, 21, whatever it was, final regular season game, he said, hey, we're all going to get together afterwards and talk about who we're voting for so we don't split the votes, to make sure that whoever we agree on is going to end up. And I said, sorry?
What?
And he said, yeah, I mean, we don't want somebody to miss out on an award from, you know, the team award from the Ticats, because we're splitting votes because we all have these varying opinions, and we're not putting together a unified bid to get somebody from the Ticats the best opportunity to win the award. And I said, John, I already submitted my ballot. Like, I did it off of what I've seen. I trust what I see. I know what I've seen. And he was, you're just a kid. What are you talking? I said, I might be just a kid, but I also believe in democracy. Like, I also believe in the idea that I'm allowed to have my ballot count as my ballot and to be able to have my say on these things that I'm seeing. So that one in Montreal, if you're splitting media members from different publications, maybe rival publications, maybe different languages that are being asked to vote, I don't think there's that synchronicity. And it honestly might have hurt Matt. They might have had other nominees where it's like, hey, let's go with a tackle as our offensive line nominee or something like that.
Yeah, it's I'm still blown away that he's 35. I really thought he was like 29. I really thought he came in young, but 2010 draft from Laval, and 10 years of being an absolute rock, but I may have to go back and amend the list there.
I'm just glad you found out now, because think about how devastated you would have been if you retired in 2 years and you're like, he's only 31. No.
Exactly. What is this, the COVID year where everybody retired at 28 and 30? My goodness, no. Yeah,
I'm terrified, when you by were the voting. Way, I'm terrified of tweets coming up that start with, we'd like to wish blank a happy retirement these days. Like, I keep seeing them come across the timeline, and every time I'm like, duh! And then I'm like, oh, it's just Jesse Joseph. We're good. It's fine.
It's gonna be, I mean, soon it's gonna be Brandon Banks or somebody. Willie's gonna decide that, no, I can make too much money doing something else. I got this on the side, I'm good. Yeah. No, please. Hey, you mentioned all-star voting. They finally split it up that you vote for two linebackers and then a cover linebacker, which was something that was coming a long time. I always found that I kind of took it a little too far, I think, in that I always looked at it, well, I have five receivers and they're all going to be boundary slot backs. So what is that really doing? Or I'm going to have two linebackers and they're both going to be middle linebackers, and there's going to be two left tackles and two boundary corners. Is that what we're voting for? So I would take it down to like position by position, and I would pick a right tackle. So it'd be like Stanley Bryant plus Jamarcus Hardrick. And I'd be the one guy who didn't vote for Derek Dennis. And then if anybody found out, I'd get yelled at. Or how is Tavon Smith on your list for All-Stars? He was the best boundary wide receiver. What do you want from me?
Yeah.
And I still don't know where to entirely go with that, because I was talking to Davis Sanchez one day, and he said, if you gave me Trey Roberson and Winston Rose, I could have a pretty good field side cornerback. I'd be okay with that. And I thought, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. If you put one of those guys in the field, they'd probably be okay.
Yeah.
LJ McCray plays there, but yeah. Okay. So how do you approach that?
Honestly, I try to do it by the quality of the play in front of my eye without doing all of the position specific. I love that you do that though, because I think that's the smartest way to do it. Shocking. DT did something smart, but the idea of sectioning these things off is, I think it's honestly the right way to do it, because I like the idea of, you play that position, we should honor you for playing that position if we're going to label it as that position. But if we're just labeling it as, you're an all-star corner, then yeah, I'm going to take the two boundary corners. It's going to be Delvin Bro and Trey Roberson. If we're doing running backs, then it's going to be William Stanback coming out of this year with Andrew Harris, probably. It's like, yeah. if we're going to do it that way, the way that it's listed as just who's the best at their position, then yeah, because we're not doing it field boundary, we're not doing it at left, right. I mean, so I just do it based on who I think is the highest talent. And honestly, in that voting process, a lot of the time, it's the name that jumps out to you. Like, if I scroll through, I really enjoy the voting process for the All-Stars because it's the guttural reaction. And I try not to let the big name, the star power, influence me. But there are some times where you see somebody, and because you and I watch so much game film and the live broadcast as well of the CFL, sometimes there's just moments where it jumps out to you where you see somebody's name and you think, man, that guy is underappreciated. And it's not trying to do the hipster pick where you go against the grain, but you see someone, you think, they're so underappreciated, and you see a big name that everybody loves. It's like, like for me, a great example of that, not, you know, Ticat homerism, was Revenberg against Stanley Bryant. I'm like, Stanley Bryant is incredible. But that year specifically, I went back and I watched all of Revenberg's games just to see how many great clips I could pull of him doing incredible offensive line things. And at least 10 to 15 times a game, he did stuff where it was, he owns, you know, two guys and is able to get to the second level, and he forearm shivers Solomon Elamimin, and then he goes and gets the free safety. You're like, that's, you shouldn't, how do you do that? That doesn't make any sense. Yeah. So I think that the requirements of what Rev was asked to do that year in June Jones' offense, getting in there, I mean, the amount of screens that they ran, the smoke screens out to Brandon Banks, where he would chuck a D tackle, get out to a corner, chip him, and keep running to a halfback. Like, they did that so many times. I'm going, Stanley Bryant's not asked to do that. Stanley Bryant is asked to widen the edge, which I respect. He's incredible at it, but he's not getting out and running 35 yards down the field in space, hitting three different people and changing direction. So that was one for me where I'm like, I don't know if this is a hipster pick, but I chose Rev as the offensive line pick that year. Stanley Bryant won. And I was like, that's fine. That totally makes sense. He probably should win. But I felt like if you're really watching the film and you're studying the requirements of what these guys are asked to do, I deem what Rev did that year more special. So I like going through that process and figuring out who really deserves it based on what they're asked to do. Cause that's a different conversation than who's the best.
Yeah. And I've run to that spot, try to pick who's the best tackle at certain spots in the league, right? Because what Stanley is asked to do in a quick passing offense in Winnipeg was different from what did they ask Derek Dennis to do in a deeper passing offense where Bo's standing in the pocket. Bo still standing in the pocket. Bo is totally unmolested in the pocket, right? And Sir Vincent Rogers in Ottawa with another quick stride offense when that was Trevor Harris, right? Sometimes you get down into those. You took a guard over a tackle, though.
I know.
That is.
I had watched so much Revenberg. My brain was so polluted at that point that I couldn't not appreciate what he was doing. And I even told him, I'm like, listen, man, I voted for you, and I bet you don't win. And he's like, oh, I know I'm not going to win. Like, everybody's going to vote for Stanley. I'm like, well, I voted for you just because I actually watched what you do. Cause I think a lot of people are like, that dude, Stanley Bryant's a monster. He's the best tackle. He gets the award. Well, it's not called the best tackle award. It's called the most outstanding lineman award. So for me, I was thinking that if you're the most outstanding lineman for what you do in my eyes, then yeah, I get it. Like, I was wrong in the eyes of the voters. I was in the wrong. But I stand by that take because it wasn't a fly-by night. Hey, I'm just going to vote for a guy because I talked to him in the locker room. It was, no, I don't care if I know you. I don't care if I'm friendly with you on game day, on training camp day one. Otherwise, I watched what you did and I saw how special he was at what he did. And I was like, well, I'm going to try to honor what you did because you put the work in and I put the work in to watch it.
Yeah, there was a season where, and I hope we're not talking about the same season where Bryant, I had him allowing 9 quarterback pressures in 18 games.
He's great. Like, he's great. Yeah,
I know. It's just to put your brain around that and go, okay, well, you played Charleston Hughes and you played this guy and you blocked it and you just swallowed them whole. And yeah, the quick strike offense helps in some of that, but just monsterific. Have you ever had to, you ever had guys text you and go, hey, who are you voting for All-Star? And you had to tell them it wasn't them?
I had that actually from a punter.
Isn't that the worst?
I had that from a punter, and you probably know which punter it was.
No way. Yes.
Which I've experienced multiple times. Special teamers seem to feel more jilted by this stuff, it seems like, than positional guys. Most positional guys are like, whatever, man. Like, I still get my paycheck. I don't really care. But, you know, if I don't know if there's specific bonuses that are built into certain special teamers and what they like to do. But, that's always a challenge. That is going to do it for us this week on The Breakdown. DT, again, thank you for working around all this stuff. We are looking forward to getting this out, getting people's feedback on all this. If you want to follow Derek, at DT on SC is where you can find him. I am at @TSN_Marsh. Reminder, as always, the Canadian Football Perspective podcast is brought to you by our friends at Fox 40, the worldwide leaders in whistle technology. For 15% off all your return to play whistle needs, you can visit fox40shop.com and enter the code CFP15. And as always, a big shout out to our friends at Soda City Brewing. It is always great to have them on board. Soda City Brewing Company offers brewery fresh beer delivered directly to your door. Visit their website at sodacitybeer.com to shop their wide variety of brews and to learn more. This April, CFP listeners are getting an exclusive promo code. Use CFP during checkout to receive free shipping on all orders over $100. Shipping is available to Ontario residents only. Sorry, Riders fans, must be of legal drinking age. Coming up for you on Friday, we are going to have our weekly Soda City tasting, something we're doing every Friday that comes out on YouTube and our social at CF Perspective. And this week, it's going to be Connor and Wade holding it down for you as they're going to be talking with Sawdust brewmaster and co-founder Sam Corbet, as he is going to end up talking about all things Narnia IPA, which I actually have not been able to have yet, but it looks delicious. So I'm looking forward to getting that. I won't have it this weekend, though, because they're ripping my wisdom teeth out of my head coming up on Thursday. So I'm going to be down and out. I'm going to be gassed, and I'm looking forward to giving you a full report and hopefully getting back to 100% in time to do the A block coming up at the start of very next week. Thank you, as always, for listening. We do appreciate it. Follow us at CF Perspective, and we'll talk to you next week right here on The Breakdown.